Housekeeping. If you are interested in continuing after this is over, I've come up with two ideas for you. This is the one I mentioned on Dreams and Death. Did I bring this last time? Von Franz. This one would be a large project. It's Gerhard Adler's The Living Symbol. I'll pass it around. It's a case study. One case study of a woman in analysis. It's a happy story. I guess that's what's different from this. We have been doing depressing stuff, but this work is depressing sometimes. That's the reality of it. But just for your consideration, so you can think about it. But I think that would be a meaty project. This would be, it's not that long, you know, and it's not that hard, but it'd be interesting. So I'm trying to stick with, you know, primary sources of Jungians working on dreams so that we see how the work is done. That's sort of my goal here.
Have you, sometime in your future, got the book I just read about it, on divination and synchronicity?
I have it. It's not hard. It's like a prequel to Number and Time. I think you'd be bored.
Really?
Yeah. Well, it would be things you'd heard. You have heard. It's her first formulation of Number and Time. So I'll think about it. Another thing I said I would bring along is this book that's just been published, An Homage to Von Franz.
The what?
An Homage to Von Franz on the 10th anniversary of her death.
What's the name of it?
The Fountain of the Love of Wisdom.
And who wrote it?
Well, it's essays of people who knew her, and actually I'm in here, so I thought I'd read you what I wrote.
Oh, good. You didn't tell us that.
Just a couple of paragraphs. But it's all people who knew her and what they thought about her. All people, all of her students.
Oh, okay.
Is that inner city?
No, this is Chiron.
Oh, thank you.
The Fountain of the Love of Wisdom. It just will give you a feeling for who she is. It's lovely essays about it. Personal sense. So here's my personal sentiment. I had the pleasure of writing my thesis in Zurich for Dr. Von Franz. What I remember was the way she felt into me, into what I was trying to express, and into the importance the work had for the evolution of what might become my creativity. She liked the work because I was trying to be creative, even though now I see how incomplete the product was. It apparently didn't matter to her that the result was mediocre, but that an honest-to-God attempt was being made to wrestle with the creative process. That is what she threw her weight behind. I also knew her as a lecturer and examiner. No point in going on about her brilliance, but there was something even more impressive, the way her brilliance challenged my limited best in learning the analytic craft. Her intellect was keenly sharp, yet its force was based on love and not power. Thus, her demand for competence never felt pushy, though it could have the might of a hurricane. She was saying, look at this civilization. Its story must be understood at depth to do the suffering human spirit justice. I always felt I was being introduced through rigor to an excellence I had long been hungry for. Who wouldn't want to achieve that, and who wouldn't want to cooperate? It was the first time I ever felt authority really serve the essence of life. She was exacting for the sake of sufficient analytic response to the modern climate. This challenge is something I wanted to be part of. I was struck by her balance of tolerance and precision. Others have well described her incredible mixture of distinction and simplicity. Probably above all, I recall the intensity and humanity of her creative spirit, which burned straight to the center, inspiring in me a reevaluation of everything.
Wow, beautiful.
Yeah. We left off with Pauli's dreams of scientific images, page 245. Why is that so important? Well, I think a couple of reasons. One, it's the ostensible reason Pally and Jung parted ways, because Pally refused to acknowledge that these dreams had a symbolic meaning. We talked about why, because Pally probably clung on to the rational part of science, first ability, in introducing the idea that this world couldn't be at the could be influenced by dreams was upsetting. But I think there's even a bigger importance. And I tried to talk about it last time. Let me get some coffee. I'm not sure I don't have coffee. Steve Carr, you go away and everything falls apart.
I wish I know a little something about that.
The other thing is a bigger issue that, you know, we hear about the runaway nature of science and technology, and that it's produced so many complications in our life, and it's a valueless enterprise, and it's greed-based, and so on. But and there's a lot of discussion about, so how do you humanize technology? How do we ensure that it serves human ends and not impersonal ends of power and so on? Well, I think this is the way if you look at the dreams of these people, such as Pally, who are doing technical scientific research, we saw last time, Eileen picked it up right away, that there's this real compatibility between our symbolic thinking and those dream images in Pally's scientific dreams, that a dream may talk about a split in an atom, we talk about a split in a personality. So that if we can begin to understand how to interpret the dreams of these scientists, it gives them a way to bring consciousness to what they're doing, and gives them a way to bring the feeling function to what they're doing, to begin evaluating what they're doing. I think that's the ultimate reason why it's so important. We know how to interpret art. We know how to interpret dreams. We can interpret music. We can interpret dance. But no one has really said, let's interpret science. But we've seen that science has at its bottom as much of an imagistic process as anything. So it too can be a vehicle for the scientist's self-knowledge and for our coming into relationship with this incredibly powerful tool we've created to begin to evaluate it and control it and legislate it. That's why I think it's so important. So we go to bottom of 245. Now, the author, again, he goes way off, I think. The author goes way off, and I don't think we have to make it so complicated. But let's just read the dream, and then I'm going to try to give you a simplified interpretation of it. By the way, it's drawn on page letter F at the back of your guide to 1, 2, 3, 4 A's, and then the circle.
And the list.
Yeah, that list is for the other dream, though.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, I think. Wait a minute, yeah.
Probably.
A woman comes with a bird which lays a large egg. This egg divides itself in two. See how it splits. I go closer and notice that I have in my hand another egg with a blue shell. I divide this last egg into two. Miraculously, they remain whole, and now I have two eggs with blue shells. The four eggs change in thought. Thank you. Where'd you find the ice?
I went in the office and they have water and coffee stuff.
Oh.
So I had to go there.
There you go. Okay. I asked you.
Thank you. The four eggs change into the following mathematical expression. Cosine of x over 2, sine of x over 2, cosine of x over 2, sine of x over 2. This gives a formula, cosine of x over 2 plus I, remember I, square root of negative 1, times the sine of x over 2, divided by cosine of x over 2, minus I, sine of x over 2. I say the whole thing gives E equals IX, and that is the circle. The formula vanishes, and a circle appears.
E equals IX, that is the circle?
Right.
What does it mean?
Well, E is, what's E, Ted? 2.3?
Yeah, 2.3.
And how do they get that number? You know? I forget all that stuff. Yeah, I forget. It's like pi, you know, pi 3.14.
Oh, I'm thinking, so this is like the
yes.
XY?
XY axis.
Axis, right. And this formula gives
right.
S circle
y
XY axis.
Y equals E to the IX gives a circle. Does that make sense, everybody?
Y equals...
No.
Don't worry. Uh-huh, that's... Okay.
Well, it's important.
It makes sense.
Let me draw it.
I don't see where you have... Why do we have Y left out of the formula?
Oh, because you would know that.
Oh.
If you're mathematically...
I see.
We try.
Thank you, David.
It's really... It looks more complicated than it is. I think it's 2.3 something. The square root of negative 1. Square root of negative 1 is that the I. Now, if you got a calculator out and you put in here x equals 0.1, x equals 0.2, x equals 0.3. If you did that for each value, 0 to 1, you would get for each value of x, you would get a different value of y. Just don't even think conceptually, just in punching in a little calculator, this formula s equals 0.1, let's say this is 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, 0.4, 0.5, 0.6, up to 1. With the y value you get, you could plot, and it would form a circle for all values of x. You did x here and here, you would, I think you get two possibilities for each one. So that's how you go. Positive x minus x. You calculate y in the calculator, and if you plotted all the values of x versus y, you get a circle. Well, I don't know.
That they like each other?
That they like each other. That works. Yeah.
My math is
pretty bad. So that's I. That's I. That's 4. And again, this is algebra. This formula, y equals I, can be expressed in many other ways. Like, and they've given you some of the other expressions: sine plus cosine, blah 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 blah. It doesn't really matter for our purposes. What for our purposes I think is important is you first get circles in the pattern of 4. And then in the dream, for reasons we don't understand, each of these circles turns into a mathematical expression so that you get a formula of this value plus this value or this value plus.
You mean that's not a standard formula that he's showing?
This is a standard formula.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, that is a standard. That is another expression for that.
Right. But it was a standard.
But it's standard, yeah. Now, you know, a physicist would know...
It didn't come out of his dream.
No.
Okay.
A physicist would know that this formula and this formula are the same.
Because when they do calculations and they try to look for similar figures and then boil it down. Again, the details aren't important. What's important is how the dream goes from a shape to a mathematical formula. And that mathematical formula is a formula for a circle, which is made up of two parts, an imaginary part and a real part. That's because this formula, when you compute it out, will yield will yield numbers that are this place on the graph here is a mixture of a real number and an imaginary number.
She's asking why that's significant, I think.
You're asking why that's significant.
Is that right?
Probably both. Why are you saying, you must be saying it's significant.
Right, because it's showing him why it's made up of two dimensions. An imaginary dimension and a symbolic dimension and an earthly dimension. A Sophia dimension, if you will, and a time and space dimension. That's the point of all of this. I was just trying to show you a little bit of this thought process. Not that you would have to understand it, but that you realize that there is a series of limits. And the bottom line is that the dream shows him a unity made up of two parts. And that's what he cannot get through his head. Life is made up of two parts. The demands of self.
And then I do what?
Reality. This is von Franz. This is his work. This is von Franz. This is the command from the self to be with. And what is so important is it looks like this completely mathematical expression, but if you can apply your symbolic mind to it, you realize that mathematical expression is also symbolically valid. Just like, that could have been Athena and Zeus, but it's square root of -1 and E and Y and X, but it's just as symbolically important. That's the point. And he's saying, no, it isn't symbolically important. But you see how pregnant these images are with meaning.
But in some sense, he has accepted the alchemical approach, right?
Well, he flips. Sometimes he does.
And that is at the essence of the alchemical approach, right?
You could say that, yeah.
In a sense.
Yeah.
Without using a sophisticated mathematical approach.
Right, right.
The thing came up before was the -1.
That is the -1.
This is the -1 again.
Yeah. Square root of -1.
Square root of -1.
It just appears in a dream. So here's this very abstract concept, which you really don't even need to understand, to see the dream portrays a unity made up of an imaginary and a real part. That's the whole point. And, you know, if you do know mathematics, it does make sense what he does. But you don't need to know that, too.
So how does he get around with not facing it? I'm not sure.
It's a miracle that he could continually avoid seeing this.
Well, he sort of sees it and then
he sees it and then puts it away. He sees it and puts it away. He will see it and accept it. He will see it and accept it intellectually only. He will then, in 2 days' time, completely reverse his opinion.
And did anybody confront him on that?
Sure. Von Franz was harrying him with it. And what he would do when she would was disappear. Suddenly he'd be going to America, or he had an important congress to go to, or had to go on a vacation, or was busy doing research. I mean, this is the way these people were.
Well, what's interesting too is this is
a reality for all scientists, not even just him.
Right.
And so all scientists are just kind of ignoring
him? I'm afraid that's the conclusion we have to reach. There are many things that we're knocking on Pauly's door. We've seen this whole business of the challenge to science of synchronicity, and that he was to begin to articulate that publicly. The other is that this whole realm of opening up science to psychological understanding. He could have been the first. No one has done this yet. This is work for future generations. You know, if we could see if a couple of nuclear physicists could actually get in analysis, and von Franz says this in one of these interviews. I'll see if I can find it. Where we could demonstrate how the process of scientific creativity is symbolically relevant to their own individuation and to our understanding of the time, it would be a huge step forward to bringing our technology and its power drive under control. This would be the way to do it.
Would you start that off again, symbolically?
Well, if we get, what we really need is case studies of nuclear physicists who would go through a process at depth where we could swatch how their dreams of their scientific creativity are vehicles for their own self-knowledge, and how that helps them begin to establish a feeling relationship to the nature of science so as to be able to make value decisions about what will be researched and what will not be researched. Now, the only criteria for what is researched in science is that it's possible. If it's possible, it's done. And no one ever says, but what's the consequence of that? And being the feeling function in would give people a tool to begin saying, no, that realm of research we're not going to pursue, and that we will, because the soul is behind this and not behind this. Now, is that going to change the world? No. But it might be a way to begin exercising moral judgment over a field which up to now we see no methodology for moral involvement.
You really need to speculate about how different cultures throughout history can change, that appear and disappear.
Yeah.
And you wonder is that kind of thing, culture that is risen to a high state, or that kind of thing, you're talking about present or here, and they do, in fact, do something. They do it because they can do it.
Yeah.
And then the group is.
Well,
and that may be the reason why we don't know that anymore, because they don't think, they don't get that point of thinking. Like
I'm with you 100%, gazillion percent. I would take it a step further. Now I'm thinking out loud, so, I might phrase this with more care if I had, put it before a public, but I've always been fascinated by Toynbee. Arnold Toynbee, the historian. And his thesis is that, I think I've said it before, but let me re-say it in light of your comment, that a civilization grows by responding to a challenge. And the irony of the growth and collapse of civilizations, in his understanding, is that the very success of meeting one challenge itself becomes another challenge which has to be met, or the civilization collapses. I give a simple example. Ancient Greece defeated the Persians and formed the Delian League, and in doing so established its dominance and grandeur in the Mediterranean. The very success of those wars led to a league which eventually destroyed itself through infighting in the Peloponnesian Wars. So one success led to another challenge which was not met, and the challenge posed by a previous success destroyed, the unmet challenge posed by a previous success destroyed the civilization. Now I think where that's applicable to our era is that our great success is technology. We have mastered infrastructure, and if you've ever traveled in the third world, you know what that means, that you don't see children dying on the street, you don't see diseased people hanging around, life is not for sale here like it is in the third world. You can buy anything for about $200 anywhere in the world, in the third world. Sex, murder, whatever. We have achieved something, and I don't, I'm not unaware of that. But the irony is that very success is now in danger of destroying us. Nuclear, environmental, and social pressures caused by the unequal distribution of income thanks to the success of industry. And so when toying these ideas, then what makes the difference is that a creative individuals then are attacked by the need to solve the new challenge inwardly. And I think that's where Pali fits in. So that, yes, we're not just talking about a man's life here. We're seeing the need for us to begin to control our technology and control our power drive. And I think this is one response of the psyche to that issue. Here is the way to do it. And up to now, it's not been met. And it's scary, I think, that if we apply that set of criteria to this material, that this guy, Pali, is not just working on his dreams. He's working on how does our times need to change its attitude to survive? And he failed.
He didn't listen.
And what's that mean for us? Somebody has got to take this task up, because our very success is in danger of destroying us. And again, there's nothing wrong with the technology, just that it's applied without considerations of value. Profit motive and possibility. A new medical treatment. Let's do it. I was last weekend, I was at a work, doing a workshop, and there was a dermatologist there, and I still had that stuff on my face, so we were talking. And he said the same, in my profession, he's come across A. McGuire's book. And he wants to study Jungian psychology, and he said, in my field, I have people come in with psoriasis. I know it's psychosomatic. I have to prescribe a treatment for them. It's $40,000 a year. I know it's ridiculous, but I have to do it, or they won't come back. So that's where technology is. Whenever it's possible, whatever is possible, we have to do. And this, I think, is a beginning on a small level, too. Okay, let's feel what's going on. Let's evaluate what's going on by the images that are beneath it.
It's kind of interesting that some of the nuclear scientists at the time were really, in a roundabout way, thinking a little bit longer in that way, in the sense that they knew that they were going to go out there and do the thing that could be done.
Yeah.
But they really urged Pali to not be a part of that, which could be done.
Yeah.
And almost kind of suggesting that you carry on this fight.
I think you're right.
I mean, it so parallels our own individual. If we just use our preferred function and do stuff what is possible, for power drive reasons, and we just keep on doing that until we get the sick of it.
It really does.
And then we have to come to terms with our own power drive and what are the consequences of what we do.
and inclusive. So for every person.
I think it's important that we learn. Well, that's, I think if you got that, you got the chapter. There's a lot more, but.
Really?
Is it the power drive that is keeping scientists from accepting this dimension?
I believe so.
I can't see how it would work there, the search, but maybe it's an ego drive.
I think it's like trying to describe the ocean to somebody who doesn't know what a glass of water is. There's just no
opening. Are mathematicians this way too?
I don't know.
Okay, a sister and brother-in-law who are both PhD mathematicians at the University of Illinois. So maybe I'll find out.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, on the other hand, I think what is so valuable about Pali, he knew this was important. You know, that's what's so tragic. He knew that science, he knew that his so-called rational scientific work was based on an imaginative process, and that science isn't linear.
Okay, Edison.
Yeah, its testing is linear. But the creative process is highly unlinear, and therefore amenable to the feeling and to understanding, symbolically.
And I mean, and this, that is too. If we know what the truth is, and we keep messing around with it, when we intellectualize and rationalize,
yeah,
you know, we'll play the same damn game.
Yeah, right. Yes.
Much smaller proportion.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just look, since I've moved here, Castleton to Keystone, one big slab of concrete. See what I mean, it's not just physicists, it's not just, it's a whole lifestyle that is based on doing without reflections on quality. Just because it's possible. And that there's money to be made.
That is power, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, make more money. Because it's possible. You make more,
and,
we put more money in
our bank account. And I think also it's not just money, it's the thrill of accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
They're, it's like they're stoned on effort, the effervescence of doing things. And underneath all that, what you would think of is, well, what could be more, what could be less symbolic than building a shopping center or designing a nuclear reactor? You see that the dreams are working, and they are amenable to understanding, and they do have something to say.
Very much. We were invited to listen to this investor who, basically what they do is invest in strip malls. And this guy was pitching it, and he was so, I mean, he was just so wrapped up in it, and so, you know, this is the greatest thing, spread. And a lady across from the table, I said, I can't get my thumbs up, she's like, hey, do we really need more? How many more strip malls do we need in this country? But yet this guy, you know, he was just, oh, he's so excited about it.
Yeah, and see what would temper that is awareness of the two dimensions. That this is what I'm excited about doing, but where is the imaginary realm in this, and what is its idea about what I'm doing?
I think it's really interesting because it's. This morning in the paper, there was an article about the GPS bulb system and how it's in danger of being, undermined, essentially because of forces in nature that are doing these bursts of the sun power, and it's getting in the way. And but it's making them. That happened in December. I know. It happened in December, on December 6th, I guess.
Oh, it's sunspots. Sunspots.
Sunspots. Okay. Sunspots. Yeah, and so it's basically crippling the ability of the GPS to function. And I thought that's interesting because Mother Nature's
Yeah.
Now, you know,
it's occurring.
I mean, yeah.
Maybe we can fall in the sun.
We'll figure out a way to not have that.
And how much are these sunspots doing in global warming?
Yeah, so that's what they said. All of this, you know, take billions of dollars probably to rectify, figure out how to go up against that force and rectify, you know, and fight against that nature force. And instead of,
I just find it interesting that they use the word imaginary.
Mm-hmm.
But they can't. They can do it up here, but they can't.
They can't really understand. They can't understand the implications of their own scientific imagery.
Exactly.
Because it is as much a metaphor as it is a scientific fact.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Splitting of the atom. You know, splitting the ground state. All that is absolutely amenable to our language.
It is just incredible to me that somebody is interested in it.
Well, I think it's work for the future. And I hope, I don't know whether I'll be able to do it or who will do it, but I think it's very important.
It was my 8-year-old grandson.
It could, I mean,
or my 8-year-old grandson.
I think it is really future. Here is Jung's seeds for future generations.
Why is it, since we're here as a group recognizing it, and there's got to be young groups all over the country,
yeah,
that somebody isn't grasping it?
I think it's just starting. I think we're really at the beginning of a swell. I mean, I hope so. That, you know, it may have ups and downs in 5 or 10 year periods, but in the next 100 years, Jung's tools will be accepted for the quality that they are, and the uses found for them in these issues. And I think just even, you know, in our since Pauli's date and now, science is much more open,
mm-hmm,
and I suspect it will become more so. But still, the point of this dream was just to show you how science can have a symbolic meaning for the scientist and then for the development of science, period. And maybe even for the survival of our civilization. That's why I think this stuff is so important.
Yeah, because if we don't figure out a shortage of how to deal with the shortage of water,
right,
it won't be there.
Not in the amateur drive.
Well,
I mean, yeah, the environment is now attacking back,
mm-hmm,
and it's not going to stop. We will probably be able to ignore it. Your great-grandchildren will not be able to ignore it. So to me, it's as hopeful. Even though the man himself failed, you can see how the unconscious is bringing us to re-examine old assumptions from a new light. I think it's exciting. And for me, this is where Jung's work may yield some real fruit.
You know that whole thing of the snake life?
Yeah.
How this work goes? And then you see something, and you hit the inside, and then you don't have it, and then you get it, and then maybe you accept it, and you don't accept it. And, you know, that whole thing we go through, obviously going through, do you think it ultimately comes down to the acceptance? I mean, the power drive of being able to deal with the power drive?
Yeah.
The acceptance.
I do, yeah. And that is what.
Definition.
And then that is what our future depends on.
Don't you think a lot of people operate out of their power drive without realizing that?
Mm-hmm. Just because it's the way the program is played off.
But even after you recognize it, then you play games with yourself,
yeah,
and you don't accept it. And then you go back until it causes you so much pain and suffering, you kind of figure out, well, I've got to do something about this. So, I mean, you know, you're going back and forth with that. It's not like, you know, I get it, and
I see it,
and it's all solved. You know,
yeah,
it just doesn't work that way.
Just when you go out socially, meet somebody new. See if you think it's a equal encounter. Or is it, you make more money than me, or I make more money than you? Now, do you have more powerful friends than me, or do I have more powerful friends than you? Do you drive a bigger car than me, or do you drive a smaller car than me? I bet you will find 90% of the time, as soon as you meet somebody, there's a calculation that starts. What box do you fit into? And that's just life. And it's sad. And that's power. And not just, hi, are you an interesting person or not?
It's also competition. Where does that
It's the same thing. Competition. Yeah, you it's almost impossible to meet somebody without competition beginning. And it sucks. And it's killing us, I'm afraid.
It's what?
It's killing us.
And I never realized that young said
yeah, you hate the competition. Yeah.
They thought that was really bad for the soul.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's inborn, which it must be, because everybody has it.
Yeah, well, I think the trick is that you compete against yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we measure ourselves
against
not so much that
right.
I'm judging you, but how do I measure up?
And really what you're competing against is that imaginary axis. Where am I in relation to its view of me? That's where the competition belongs. Am I measuring up to it, or am I not measuring up to it? Well, it's the viewpoint of the self on us.
Okay.
And that's who puts that's where the competition belongs. That I
that's where it belongs.
It's where it belongs.
I thought you meant the collective.
Yeah. No.
That
we compete is not almost the right word, because it's not really competition anymore, but that we strive, that our striving to improve isn't to improve over somebody else, but to reach what we are asked to be, which is a kind of a battle.
Yes.
And it is a kind of a competition in a way.
I would call it striving.
Yeah, it's a bad word, competition.
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's bad or good, but I mean, the striving just feels like it's more like striving.
Mm-hmm.
Because I never measure up to what I think I should be at in terms of the self.
Okay,
just on it, is the self is always trying to get you to be whole,
mm-hmm.
not perfect, but whole.
Right.
Yeah,
that's a good thing.
Mistakes belong to the bargain. 177. So that's all I'm going to do on that dream, unless you've got any questions.
I just had a little question.
Yeah, shoot.
Page 248. Middle of the page, right before the quote, some of his own dreams.
Yes.
He talks about the motif of doubling,
mm-hmm.
and he says, the motif of doubling then normally points to synchronicity. And then his quote, he talks about in a synchronistic experience, there are two incommensurable facts.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what Jung usually means by the idea of doubling, is it? When he talks about something doubling before it comes to consciousness? Or is that what he means? You know, when you have a dream and you dream of something double, and then Jung will say, well,
yeah,
that means it's going to be, it's heading for consciousness,
right.
But it's splitting into its opposites.
Yeah, I don't think he's quite accurate here then. It might be more accurate to say, motif of doubling sometimes points to synchronicity.
Because it seems to me like this is not exactly doubling, but opposites. Well, he's talking about opposites when he talks about doubling, but
he's not.
They're both in the unconscious in that doubling.
He's not being very precise here.
Okay.
Because look at what Jung says. Some of his own dreams. And some of other people always follow the same pattern. One finds something impossible in reality. Well, that's not doubling, but that's what... And I can't say I have confirmed that, but that's what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
I think that doubling idea follows mathematical approach.
Oh, this is Jung speaking, though.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought he was...
No. But here's what I think he means by doubling, or a coincidence of two incommensurable facts. In other words, what Jung is saying is that there are certain dreams that precede synchronicity.
Oh, is that what he's talking about?
I can't. I have watched to try to figure that out, and I have never been able to see that. Maybe he's seeing something I'm not. I don't know.
How does recruit coming before the synchronicity?
That, you know, is there a type of dream that shows that synchronicity is around the corner?
They don't usually bother. The dream misses.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
right.
Why interject?
Yeah, like, you know, do people, it's silly. Do people dream of frogs between before synchronistic experiences? Do they dream of cats before synchronistic experiences? Is there a, other than the image which repeats itself in reality, is there a, and I haven't seen it. I even wish there would be so I could give a talk on it. But there isn't.
Does the next quote have any bearing on this?
Go ahead.
An unexpected content, which is directly or indirectly connected with some objective external event, coincides with the ordinary psychic state. This is what I call synchronicity.
Yeah.
And I maintain that we are dealing with exactly the same category of events, whether their objectivity appears separated from my consciousness in space or in time.
Right. No.
Doesn't bear on that, huh?
Well, it's just the word doubling. It's not real accurate in the author's text. Doubling, you know, when you have two of things in a dream, it often means, now this I can say, it often means something is going to come to consciousness.
That's the usage that...
Yeah, that's what you're familiar with, yeah. So, you know, if you're going to write your thesis, you will dream of getting two books, and that means it's time. Other than that, I can't say that there is a typical dream indicating synchronistic experience. Maybe there is, but if there is, I haven't seen it.
Well, it seems like all this mathematical formula
just,
would be interesting if you were a mathematician.
Oh, not even.
No?
This is where I lose patience with this guy. He just goes way off.
You don't think he was feeling some sort of numinous thing in there that he...
Yeah, he was, but
him,
it was...
But it wasn't...
But it was, like... It's not related to reality. You'll notice, and I think particularly at this part of the book, he just goes off on these symbolic tangents, which are...
And then can't bring him back.
And can't bring him back. So my fantasy is, I don't know whether this is true, the first part of the book, he talked to the von Franz. The second part of the book, this is more his work. Because it's just, he gets lost in the symbolic details.
It's not as grounded.
Which are not grounded. Mm-hmm. Remember that, you know, he goes on and on and on and on about the dance and the square and the stars and blah, blah, blah. And von Franz just says, well, but it just shows that Pauli was rigid. Mm-hmm. That's all you need.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sort of That sort of explains his comment maybe on 250 in the middle where he says the seventh step is at a level of intuitive knowing.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean...
Blah, blah,
that's
blah.
That's like a contradiction in terms.
Blah, blah, blah,
knowing.
Blah, blah.
If it's the intuitive thing, it's like you don't really know for sure.
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Don't even bother. I didn't even bother. The measuring unit, and this, in fact, links the trigonometric functions, cosine, sine together, and furthermore in such a way that...
Well,
give me a break.
It's interesting that also at the time and eternity are reconciled.
To me, that's the point of the dream. It's a reconciliation of eternity and time. And, you know, even if you knew the mathematics, the important thing is that the dream shows the evolution of a figure made up of time and timeless, imaginary and real, possible and impossible. Square root of negative one is an impossibility.
I thought that was kind of interesting, not mathematical, but the thing he has at the bottom of page 251 on the Egyptian alchemy, I guess it's called it. The metal.
Yeah, I think it's too much information. I think it's too much information.
Oh, it is. No, I'm talking about outside of that.
Yeah.
As you pointed out in alchemy, that it goes back to Egypt, I guess, from the starting point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think all that symbolism gives certain people a better feeling of what's going on. I mean, depending on your type, you know?
Do you think it does?
It can appeal to type and get you and, you know, pull you in because it relates to your way of experiencing the world. So, I mean, a certain person could appreciate this, I suppose.
I'm not one of them.
No, because it's like your opposite.
Well, I think it's just inflated.
Is that
really
the author speaking?
How so?
Yeah.
So the author's added that, not the author.
Are you referring to that paragraph? Oh, you're talking about the mathematics. Oh, you're on a different page.
I think we're a couple of us are on a different page.
No, I'm talking about, when you're referring to this paragraph, are you still referring to the mathematics?
I was referring to the paragraph you the Egyptian.
Yeah. I didn't know you were still fascinated with the mathematics. That's good.
No, no, I'm
that's
agreeing.
That's mathematical already.
No, I'm agreeing with you.
Oh, okay.
Maybe you're right, Gary. It's not a good thing. We're getting all confused.
Well, I know. You get titillated by the image.
Yeah.
And you forget what it applies to. And if it doesn't apply to something, don't bother. Because that's just infatuation.
The Jung style is to amplify.
Amplify, right.
But this is, the point to amplify some from the beginning.
And then when you amplify, you bring it back mm-hmm. to Earth.
Now, he does say something that paragraph, that star was right.
Okay. Go ahead.
Speaking of, I'm puzzled. This is the author speaking. This is the author.
What page?
Yeah. Oh, now on the 252. It actually starts at the at the time of 252. Indeed, the old Egyptian, there is no significant difference between resurrection and creativity. Is that?
Yeah. What? What? What does that mean?
Huh?
What does that mean? It doesn't mean anything.
Well, I thought it was some deep insight.
I know you did.
And I'd like to know what the insight is.
And I'm trying to educate you how to separate wheat from chaff.
Okay.
Well, it could be meaningful if it applied to one's life and the symbol amplified something going on in one's life, and you could bring it into reality and say, well, okay, this is symbolizing this sort of dynamic in my life.
Mm-hmm. Maybe like in the artistic life, where you, in a sense.
Yeah, well, that would be a good thing.
I'm sorry, I brought that.
You're forgiven.
And resurrection means new life, uh-huh. And creativity is needed for new life. I mean, that's the only way I could do it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how I'd type it.
I think it's interesting to see artists. Wow, I said, you would never relate to it, but you do.
I never seen that stated that way like that. Yeah, I thought it was.
I haven't seen one.
But I see.
Say it this way.
And this is what you're saying, the author gets into the same game that Holly is in terms of.
I don't think it's defensive in our author's part. Okay. It's just inexperienced.
Okay.
And I think it's a danger of my field that you get intoxicated by the dream and you forget to ask what it's pointing to. The imagination is very important, but so is the reality that it points to. And you have to have your feet balanced on both places. It's very, you know, most people commit the error of not enough imagination. He's got an imagination that it gets fascinated by its own chain of associations. It forgets to ask, what's this about?
Well, yeah, I must come clean in a sense why I was fascinated, because, you know, in Christianity we talk about the resurrection.
Yeah.
But we,
I don't think we normally think of that as creative.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I see.
But so it does make you pushes you to think of that maybe in a different light, if that's true.
Yeah.
And this is at the time of the resurrection.
Yeah, but okay, so I think resurrection means new life.
Yeah,
but you're applying it. He's applying it to something that is in his life. So that's a good.
Yeah.
Did you say?
Yeah. Let's take a break.